Hello, dear listeners. A few weeks ago, I shared that I'm teaching a boot camp as part of the courses I co-lead at magicofmemoir.com with my favorite partner in all things memoir, Linda Joy Myers of National Association of Memoir Writers. Starting this week, March 9th, we're kicking off a six-week boot camp for memoirists called Build Your Memoir from the Ground Up. It's being taught by six experts on memoir, and we're covering structure, beginnings, scene, time and transitions, voice, and takeaway, all important elements of craft that are really exciting to learn more about. And I've been teaching memoir for 10 years and editing memoirs for longer than that, and I still get a thrill from these deep dives into craft because there's always so much more to learn. So I hope you'll cruise on over to magicofmemoir.com, take a look at the course, and see who's teaching. And if you're inspired to join us, we'll see you there. If you have to miss a class, don't worry because we're recording everything and the archives stay up indefinitely. So ride on and enjoy today's show. Hello, sagaists, excavators, deep observers, and seekers of emotional truths. I am one half of The Right-Minded Show, and Grant gets the week off because we're back with another Women Lit interview, this time with the glorious Ann Patchett. The story of how this interview came about is some sort of life lesson in being ready to say yes, because I got an urgent message from the organizers of Women Lit asking, could I please, please, please interview Ann Patchett? And I can tell you that my fingers were on the keyboard writing my response before I even finished the email, because interviewing Ann has honestly been like a long time dream of mine. And so that was an obvious yes. The first book of hers I ever read was her memoir, which will come as no surprise. Truth and Beauty tells the story of her friendship with the writer Lucy Greeley, who wrote Autobiography of a Face, which happens to be another favorite of mine. And I read both of those books years ago, long before memoir was my jam. In fact, both of those books together probably cemented my love for memoir. And then Truth and Beauty led me to read Anne's novel, Bel Canto, which I adored, and I've since read nearly everything she's written. In this interview, Anne shares that she gets criticized sometimes for being too Pollyanna and for her writing being kind of too feel good. And yet, obviously, this is the exact reason people love her work so much. And of course, not all of her books are all that feel good. Quite the contrary, they're emotionally complex, dealing with subtle complexities we all face, such as in The Dutch House, which is her most recent novel, where a pair of siblings are grappling with having something taken away from them, and they pretty much never get over it. And at the center of this novel are questions about moving on, about how our grievances can become the defining force of our life, and also about the power of not letting go, which is as powerful as our ability to let go. And then there's Anne herself, famously generous, kind, and gracious, as you'll hear in this interview and every interview she does, whether she's the subject or the interviewer. And it's important to know that she does interview other people, and I highly recommend catching her in action. You can find her schedule on her website or on the website of the bookstore that she owns, which is Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee. So today's interview is an installment from Women Lit. And for those of you who are regular listeners, then you know that they'll crop up from time to time because she writes as a sponsor and supporter. And since I am a proud member of Team Women Lit, I am excited that I get to do this and interview all these amazing women from time to time. And I feel particularly lucky that I got to have this time with Ann Patchett, who I've admired for many years. So let's get into the interview. But before we do, let me just read Anne's bio to you. Anne is the author of seven novels: The Patron Saint of Liars, Taft, The Magician's Assistant, Bel Canto, Run, State of Wonder, and Commonwealth. She was the editor of Best American Short Stories 2006 and has written three books of nonfiction. She's the recipient of so many prizes, honestly, that there are too many to list here. So instead, I'll just point you to her website, annpatchett.com. It's important to note that she is one of those authors who is not only widely read, but also widely loved. And in November 2011, she opened Parnassus Books in Nashville, and she's since become a spokesperson for independent booksellers, championing books and bookstores everywhere. She lives in Nashville with her husband and their dog, Sparky, who does make an appearance in this interview. I hope you enjoy And it's Ann Patchett, so you will. Hi, everybody, and hello, Anne. My goodness, I am so thrilled to be here. I'm Brooke Warner, everyone. I'm your moderator, and it's just absolutely thrilled to be in conversation with Anne. I got the notification about 30 hours ago that I got to do this, and Anne, I've just been, your voice has been in my ears all day because I've been looking up past interviews and just kind of soaking up your goodness, so I'm just so happy to be here with you.
Thank you, Brooke, for doing this, because as I said to you in the green room, it really is just nice to talk to a human, especially on these pandemic Zoom things. You know, it's strange enough to be sitting there talking to your computer, but if there's nobody on the other end, it feels super strange. So thanks for being the smart, warm, receiving person on the other end of this.
Absolutely, my honor. And I thought we would start. Tonight's event is called The Ties That Bind, Ann Patchett on Family, Fortune, and the Search for Self, which is such a broad amount of stuff that we can talk about. But obviously, it made me think about the Dutch house and the fact that that story is so much about these two kids that have something happen to them that they never get over. And I wanted to ask you about what it was like, or I guess living with Danny and Maeve all that time, what you learned about that experience of not getting over something.
You know, it's really funny that when you're writing a novel, there are just all sorts of things that you don't see. You know, it's like, I do really believe I bring half and the reader brings half. And it's not that I sat down and thought, I'm going to write a novel about what happens when you don't get over things. And there was a way, I mean, I was writing about a brother and sister relationship, and I was writing about a long life and a life of change, and about the balance of having nothing, having everything, having nothing, working your way back to having everything again. Just the rise and fall of fortune's tide. And it wasn't until the book came out and I started getting mail from readers and people were coming to the bookstore and talking to me and saying, you know, this was a book that really helped me lay down my old hurts. This was a book that really made me think, what have I been chewing on my whole life and carrying with me that I need to let go of? And yeah, I completely get that that's a big part of the story, but it wasn't what I was setting out to do. And it was so meaningful to me. The nicest thing that's happened since this book came out was I was at Parnassus one day, and these two women who were like late 20s, early 30s came in, and they were sisters. And they said that they hadn't spoken to each other for like 5 years. And they had both read The Dutch House independently, and they reached out to each other and said, we have to just get over this. Like, life's too short. We've got to lay down our hurt and we have to come together. And they lived in different cities and they made a trip to Nashville to thank me.
Wow. That's beautiful.
Right, right. So I sort of feel like, okay, my work here is done.
Right. I did that one thing. I want to ask about something totally different, which is about villains, because interestingly, in a couple of your interviews, this question of villains came up. And I was struck by something you said in the Louise Erdrich interview, where you interviewed her about this idea that you might explore the kind of stepmother you were afraid of being with Andrea. And so was that something that also came about accidentally, or was that more of part of the purpose that drove you into the exploration of this stepmother?
So the way I write is I really think a book all the way through in my head. I don't take notes. It just changes and changes. It can take place over the course of a year. When I first started this story, it was a story about Elna. It was a story about Danny and Maeve's mother. Mm-hmm. That is a whole other kettle of fish. But I was on book tour for Commonwealth, my last novel. And then when I got home, I was interviewing Zadie Smith. One of my jobs at Parnassus is I'm the person who interviews the authors, you know, a lot of the time, not all the time. And I adore Zadie, and I'm a huge fan. And we were talking about Swing Time, which certainly was being received as a very autobiographical novel. So we're up on stage, just gotten off tour. I'm just starting to think about the novel that I want to write next. And I ask her if the book Swing Time is autobiographical. And she said, yes, but I'm not the daughter, which if you read the book, you would definitely think she was the daughter. She said, I'm the mother. And she said, I'm not the mother in this book. I'm not that mother to my children. That is the mother I am afraid of being. That is the idea. Like, that's the kind of mother that I could be. And I want to make sure I'm never that kind of mother. And so it's very autobiographical because I was drawing on my fear. And people think that writing autobiographically means drawing on things that actually happened. But what we're afraid of and what we long for actually can be a much larger part of our psyche than what happened. And so at that moment, I'm sitting up on a stage with Zadie Smith. I thought, oh, I want to write about the kind of stepmother that I was afraid of being. Now, my stepchildren are way grown, right? They're in their 40s. I haven't had this fear for a very, very long time. But when I first met them 26 years ago, I was so afraid that I was going to let them down because they had been through a lot. And my parents had married and married other people. And you know, we just all marry and divorce in my family. And so it's like our hobby. It's our brand. So I was able to tap into that, even though it was something that I hadn't felt in 23 years or whatever. I could really pull up what would be the worst thing I could have done as a stepmother. Wow, I could just access that immediately. So I could be Andrea. I could be the villain. And oddly, my body of work is so devoid of villains because I tend to be very sympathetic. And my villains always turn into sympathetic characters. But drawing villainy from myself and from knowing, okay, what was I afraid of? What was the worst thing I could have done as a stepmother? And I was actually a very nice stepmother. You know, my stepchildren really like me. We're all good. But I could pull that up right away. And that was how Andrea came about.
It's actually a great organizing principle in some way for people just to step fully into any given character. And I just wanted to ask you about that with fiction, because it's an interesting question, and this autobiographical novel stuff comes about a lot, and I teach memoir. And so I wanted to ask you about the fact of autobiographical fiction, because Commonwealth, you've said, is autobiographical fiction. Don't you think all novels are to some extent? I mean, using this, what you're talking about right now, like you're able to step into any given character. And so,
sure.
I guess I'm just curious about if you think that most people are bringing their autobiographical stories to almost every fiction that they write in some capacity.
You know, Commonwealth is a great example. My mother, when she read it, said, none of it happened and all of it's true.
Right.
And that's really the case. The things that happened to those kids did not happen to us, but the emotional heft of my childhood, my siblings' childhood, is really in that book. I took it and I dumped it all in that book. There are a lot of characters in my fiction that if you said, you know, how are you like Cyril, or how are you like Fluffy? I mean, I would have to really, really think of it. But I'm sure I could come up with something, but nothing springs to mind. But what I always think of is we are all a pack of cards. We are all 52 cards. And you could deal hands for the rest of your life on Earth, and you're not going to deal exactly the same hand. But those are your 52 cards. No matter how you arrange them, chances are I am not going to get another card. I'm not going to get a 53rd card. If I'm lucky, I won't lose any. You know, you just have to work with what you've got, and what you've got is who you are. And the reason that I wrote Commonwealth is that I felt like I had been putting so much energy in my writing life into making sure that none of the characters look like me or my family, and none of the circumstances were like my circumstances. And so, you know, we'll go to a home for unwed mothers or a blues bar in Mississippi or a terrorist takeover in Peru, or we'll go to the Amazon. And I just thought, Patchett, you are spending so much energy making trees, right? Making costumes and sets and little birds. And like, what if I took all of the energy that I put into making sets and costumes and locations and just put that into the story? And that's what I did with Commonwealth, in hopes that I was really going to free myself in some way of that repeating theme. And I feel like to some extent I kind of did, although again, it's my pack of cards.
Well, you're obviously best known for being an author, but you're very famous in the book community for being a bookseller and owning a bookstore. And I wanted to ask you about the intersection of those identities, because I sort of have this image, like you said, of these women who traveled across the country to kind of come fangirl you in your bookstore. So how do you do it? How do you run a bookstore? And like, do fans come to Parnassus to try to get you to sign books and blurb their books? And, you know, how does one exist as a very famous author and well-loved bookstore owner?
Yeah, I always say I'm America's most famous retailer now. I don't work at the store. I don't run the store. I have a partnership with a woman named Karen Hayes. We have a 50-50 partnership, and Karen and I employ Karen to run the store. When we were introduced by a mutual friend as two women who were interested in opening a bookstore, our deal was I would pay for everything and she would do all the work. And that's kind of our division of labor. I'm the spokesperson. Especially, gosh, since the pandemic has started, I, who don't have a cell phone and have never once looked at social media, I now do all these Instagram videos for the bookstore, which is hysterical because now people come up to me in the grocery store and they're like, oh, I follow you on Instagram. And I'm like, I actually don't know what that means. So
lovely dresses and
exactly.
Right. It's very, very cute. Yes, it's working. I mean, I think it's exciting for the book community too, in terms of the visibility that you're giving to independent bookstores. And I don't think people out in the public necessarily realize that, you know, that it does have kind of a ripple effect, and you're so supportive of other bookstore owners. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and thank you as a publisher, coming from the publisher hat. The other thing, a point of curiosity. I mean, I wanted to ask you about intimacy, because I mean, you just strike me as like an incredibly intimate person. It shows up in your writing. When people talk about your books, they're talking about it, things being, you know, touching and moving and intimate. And I know people have questions about this most recent Harper's piece that just published. When I said I was interviewing you, several people said, have you read this incredible story? And what I took away from the story with Suki was this, for people who haven't read it, you must. I mean, it's a long piece, but I took away this just total abandon, you know, of turning yourself over in a sense to this potential friendship that, you know, that was really intimate, you know, and unexpected for you. And so for people who don't know, Suki is Tom Hanks's assistant who you befriended and basically bring to your house to have her chemotherapy treatment. So I was curious about intimacy in your life, you know, the degree to which you do stuff like that, you know, just invite total strangers into your life, and what you think, you know, intimacy in your personality, like how it informs your fiction.
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, intimacy in that sense, or openness, you are who you are, right? Like, there are just so many things I don't do. And in a way, I have a big life, and in a way, I have a very small life. But like, I don't watch television, and I don't, again, the social media, the phone, all these things that sort of move society along now. I don't do any of that. So my life in compared to the lives of many people, and I don't have children, and I don't have a job outside the home. You know, my life is very simple and clean in many ways. And I think that that maybe makes it easier for me to invite people into my life. I'm also married to somebody from Mississippi. You know, I'm married to the friendliest guy in the world. So if I come home and say, oh, hey, Carl, I invited a total stranger who has pancreatic cancer to come and live with us for, you know, an indeterminate amount of time, he is always going to say, you are amazing. That is so great. I'm so proud of you. Boy, this is exactly what I love about you. This is going to be wonderful. I'm going to help you in any way possible. I mean, that's really something. The number of people who sleep in our house, and part of it is, it's just a good house. It's a house that's really set up for house guests. But a lot of times authors, either authors that I know, sometimes authors that I don't know, come and spend the night. And by the time the event is over and there's been a dinner and we get home, Carl's gone to sleep. And then he wakes up and leaves in the morning before that author is awake. And then he'll pick up the book 6 months later and say, do you know this person? Do you know Edwidge? Do you know Edwidge Dondicott? I was like, yeah, she's slept in our house. Really? Did I meet her? No, you didn't meet her. So anyway, it's part of it is circumstantial. Part of it is DNA. I also always think part of it is that I don't have children. Mm. And I think that whatever energy, and I'm not a maternal person, but there's, say, this energy that for most women, or many women, goes into having children and raising children. What an enormous amount of energy that must take. Incomprehensible amount of energy. And I still have that energy, right? Like, I can spend it on other people. I always think that, you know, there should be a special tax on people who don't have children. People who don't have children should always have to pay the check, because they didn't have to pay their babysitter, and they didn't have to pay their doctor bills and their school bills and, you know, all of these things. It's like people without children have all of that extra money and extra time and extra energy. So that's part of why.
And I'm curious too. I mean, you're talking about other people, but there's also the space to give that to your fiction. To give that energy to your fiction. Well, and I mean, you don't haven't only written fiction. I mean, obviously that this is nonfiction that we're actually talking about. But yeah, no, thank you. It's an interesting perspective. And I did want to ask a question about Tom Hanks, because in that piece, you call it a lark, you know, that you asked him to do your audiobook on a lark. And I thought, well, that's quite a lot of audacity, you know, and it was the one place where, that I wanted you to unpack a little bit more than you actually did. You're like, I just decided to email Tom Hanks and ask him to do my audiobook. And so what is that? And how can we be so audacious to ask those kinds of questions?
You know, I had actually asked two other people who turned me down.
Third choice.
Yeah, he was my third choice, which is not in the piece, nor have I ever mentioned to him. And I do really believe if you don't play, you don't win. If you don't, you might not get what you ask for, but you are really not going to get it if you don't ask. And I know Tom, and, you know, we're friends in a very friendly, loose definition of friendship. We know each other. And I didn't in any way think that he would be offended if I asked. And also, a friend of mine had sent me a Carly Rae Jepsen video in which Tom appears as a character in a Carly Rae Jepsen video. It's hysterical. But well, he was in a Carly Rae Jepsen video. You know, I had that moment. I was like, well, okay, it wouldn't be a huge stretch. It's not like I'm asking him to be in my music video. I just figured that he would say no, and that it was, and that he wouldn't be offended by my asking. And so I was going to ask. And he wrote back and said, oh my gosh, that sounds like so much fun. Yeah, send me the book. Let's see if this works.
It's amazing. It does strike me. I mean, it was a thing, you know. I mean, the fact that he did your audiobook was kind of making the rounds. And I imagine that the audiobook sales are just through the roof because of him. Yeah.
And it's also brilliant. I mean, when I meet somebody who says, oh, I listened to the book on audio, it makes me so happy because I feel like the book, The Dutch House, that was the best I could do. That was the very, very best book I could write. There's me. And then Tom Hanks comes in with all of his ability, the very best he could do. And then you get something that is just exponentially so much larger mm-hmm. than my talent or his talent. I mean, it really is a better book if you listen to it.
Agreed. I listened to it and I absolutely loved it. And he's such a treat to listen to. So I back to this question of the Harper's piece, because it's clearly a story about friendship. And the first book I ever read of yours was actually Truth and Beauty. And I loved that. And I came to it because I had read Autobiography of a Face. And then someone said, have you read this book by Ann Patchett about her friendship with Lucy? So that is how I made my way to you. And in reading the piece about Suki, I thought of how you write about friendship. And then I was listening to some of your interviews and you were talking about the fact that you've written about all these different kinds of sibling relationships, you know, adoptive and step and now these biological ones. And so those relationships are overlapping, of course, you know, siblings and friendships. And I just wanted to ask you kind of an open-ended question about what draws you to write about friendships, what draws you to write about siblings.
Well, siblings are interesting to me. Families are interesting to me because you can't get away from them. I love confinement in fiction. I love setting up something where people are trapped and they have to, you know, figure out how they feel. That's just a really interesting set of parameters to put on a book, trap everybody together. If you are in love with someone, if you're married to someone, you can get rid of them. You know, you really can create a circumstance where you never see that person again. Siblings, not so much. You know, parents, not so much. Even if you really, really hate them and have some horrible break with them, at some point, chances are there's going to be another moment where they come back into your life. So it's confinement. Hmm. And that's very intriguing to me. As far as friendship is concerned, friendship is perhaps my genius. I am a really good friend. I have really good friends. My closest friend is somebody that I met in second grade, mm-hmm. right? When we talk three times a week. So I'm just really good at that. And it's important. And I like to continually put that out in the world to say, this is something that's good for you. This is something that really matters, and praise it. It's right. been so important to me.
And it's wonderful to read about friendship because it makes you honor your own friendships and want to be a better friend. And I did leave that piece feeling that way. So it's if that was the intention too, it was lovely.
I'm going to say one more thing about friendship. I wrote a piece when The Dutch House came out. Real Simple magazine asked me to write a piece for the publication of the book. And I said, oh, I want to write a piece about my friend Tavia, who is my, you know, my oldest friend, as if I was writing a celebrity profile, right? But just like my regular, she is my pal. And at the end, when I turned it in, they said, well, you know, the problem with this is you guys didn't fight. You don't talk about when you didn't speak for 2 years, or when you both were in love with the same guy and you broke up and split apart, or when you were jealous, she was really pretty and you were really successful. And, you know, what about your jealousy? And I was like, no, that didn't happen. It didn't happen. And they said, well, it's going to make our readers feel inadequate. So you need to put something in so they don't feel bad about themselves. And I said, listen, if Tavia had breast cancer, if she was dying of breast cancer, you would publish this exactly as it is, because our punishment would be that she's going to die. But if she's not going to die, and we're both in good health, and we've been really good friends, and we've never hated each other or been jealous or, you know, undermined each other, this idea that in women's friendship, there has to be the dark side. Either it's the fight or it's the death. And I said, either you can run it like this, or I'm going to pull it. I don't want to make your readers uncomfortable, but I'm not going to lie and say that we were something that we were not. But the myth in society that women can't be true to one another, you know, that we can't be deep, passionate, lifelong friends is absurd.
It really is absurd. Yes. Because women supporting women, I mean, that's the other thing, is reading these kinds of pieces and you think of your own best friends and how you're there. It's really lovely. So, well, did they run it?
Yeah, they did.
Good. Good for them.
And also, I've had so many shout outs from Sookie's friends all along who said, you know, I want to be you. I want to be the one there. I want to be taking care of her. I want to be with her every day. And I'm so glad you are. And I'm so grateful to you. And you're so lucky that you're the one who gets to be there with her. And that's the truth.
Wow. That's really beautiful. Yeah. And she makes you want to be a better person. I mean, she makes you want to be a better person, but she makes us want to be a better person. And so it's just lovely. And I want to make sure, because a lot of people have asked, are all of the interviews that you do able to be accessed through Parnassus, or are they just kind of all over the place? Because I know you interviewed Louise for Book Passage, and I highly recommend, I love seeing you interview other people and just how fun it is to find interviews that you give, but also interviews that you receive. So,
do you know, honestly, I have no idea, because I do so many interviews on so many different platforms, and I don't ever look. I don't ever look. So if somebody hands me a waiver, I sign it and I never look at anything. I don't know.
Well, for people who are looking for Anne's other interviews, I will say, because I spent all day yesterday and today doing this, they're easy to find on Google. You're all over Apple Podcasts. I mean, if you want to just immerse yourself in Anne, that is possible.
That really is a sickening thought that anybody would do that. And also, it makes me feel so guilty, Brooke, that it's like I blew a day and a half of your life on this.
Oh my goodness. It's the exact opposite. My pleasure. It was so fun. And this does take us right up to the hour. So it's a great segue. I mean, really, I'm deeply honored and really happy that I got to spend these last 30 hours with you.
And as somebody who interviews people all the time, you're great at this. And oh, I'm so appreciative. I'm so appreciative that you went to all this trouble and that you were with me, because you were a great company and a lot of fun.
So isn't Anne delightful? And she was so easy to talk to. I feel like I fulfilled a career milestone with the completion of this interview. And it wasn't even nerve-wracking or angsty, because Anne is just one of those people who makes you feel right at home, welcome. If you haven't listened to The Dutch House with Tom Hanks narrating, do yourself the favor to download it. Spending that kind of time with Anne's words and Tom's voice is a treat that can buoy you if you happen to be feeling sad or just looking for the next best thing to do with your downtime. Women Lit events always leave me inspired, so I hope you'll check us out. www.womenlit.org and the Bay Area Book Festival's Unbound series, because there are lots of upcoming events. And Grant and I will be back with our regular program next week. You all know it.
We're a weekly podcast, and we're super grateful for opportunities like these ones to collaborate with like-minded people in our communities. But we're especially grateful to you, our listeners. So thank you, and I'll see you next week.